Good afternoon. My name is John Imhoff. I'm a shareholder at Vedder Price in the Maritime Practice Group, part of the bigger global transportation finance group at Vedder Price. And I am very honored today to be moderating a panel of some very distinguished speakers, all experts in their field, and it's one of the best panels, I think, of the day. And I know you're all looking forward to lunch, so this will be, I hope, the highlight of the day. You can go talk about it during the lunch break. Quick introductions. I'll let everybody introduce themselves, but to my immediate left is Evan Cohen from First Citizens Bank. Next to Evan, to his left, is Wiley Griffiths from Morgan Stanley. Harris Antonio, to his left, from Neptune Maritime Leasing. To his left, Chris Avella from Scorpio. And to his left is, Simo Spiro from Starbolt. So just quick introduction. Let each of you describe what you do, why you're on the panel, and what you bring to it. Can you kick us off, Evan?
Sure. Because I'm sitting in that chair. I don't know how that works. Anyway, Evan Cohen. I manage the First Citizens Bank shipping book. We're a classic senior lender. The interesting thing is American-based, but senior lending to major shipping sectors, dry bulk containers, tankers, gas, and that's about it.
Wiley Griffiths, I run our global transportation business on the investment banking coverage side. So as most of you know, we're a full-service investment bank, and so where we've played in the shipping or the maritime ecosystem has primarily been capital markets financing, although we do a lot of advisory. So I would say over the past 25 years, the first half was a lot of IPOs and follow-ons and a few bonds, and over the last half, it's been a little bit more about M&A and rationalization of portfolios, consolidation, and the introduction of infrastructure capital.
Harris?
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Harris Antonio. I'm the founder and managing director of Neptune Maritime Leasing. Neptune was set up almost 4 years ago to fill the void in maritime finance that was left by certain mostly European institutions exiting the market. We have then since grown significantly. We've underwritten more than, close to three-quarters of a billion transactions in the past 4 years. We currently have a fleet of about 45 ships, and we continue to grow. And we're agnostic to sectors. We've done everything from dry bulk all the way to offshore assets, and we're there to help our clients achieve their dreams.
And then over to the ship owners. Chris, please.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Chris Avella, Chief Financial Officer of Scorpio Tankers. We're a publicly traded, pure play product tanker owner. We currently own a fleet of 99 product tankers.
It's Spiros.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm Simo Spiro, Co-Chief Financial Officer of Starbulk Carriers. We are a platform owning and operating 155 dry bulk vessels.
Thank you, Zimos. I want to kind of pick up from where the previous panel left off, and we've got a combination of capital and finance providers together with ship owners, and this is a unique panel in that sense because we're going to talk about financing. And I want to pick up from the last panel by beginning with change and disruption. Find out from the ship owners, how this has changed their view in terms of capital requirements. I'll start with you, Chris, if you don't mind.
Not at all. As everyone knows, there's been a lot of volatility and uncertainty in the markets lately. As a ship owner, Scorpio Tankers, the story goes the last few years we've been deleveraging our balance sheets. We have a strong balance sheet, and capital providers have, it's been abundant to us. So the posture of our lending group and those who we're just having conversations with hasn't really changed recently in spite of the uncertainties. And part of that we attribute to, you know, taking a conservative approach. We've been building liquidity. We have a very low LTV on our balance sheet. And so, you know, when you start at that point, it's more doors open from a capital perspective. So we've definitely seen, you know, we've definitely had conversations about the uncertainty, but we haven't really seen a change in the posture from the people we borrow from.
So more of the same from Scorpio
at the moment. Yeah.
Okay. And Simos, what about Starbo?
Quite similar story. Well, uncertainty, I would say, is the name of the game today. During the last couple of years, 3 years, we have decided to start deleveraging the balance sheet significantly. We are currently on a net leverage of approximately low 20s. Our net debt per vessel has been reduced by approximately 55% since fourth quarter of 2020. We have tried at the same time to reduce costs by refinancing significantly our overall debt in order to bring costs down. And I would say that this, you know, at the end we are at, you know, a much stronger balance sheet today than what we have been a few years ago.
Is that good? You think you're going to continue on that path?
Well, you know, it's at some stage, you know, we do not see that we can go much lower than that in terms of the cost side. I mean, we are getting a new debt today at levels significantly below 150, 140, 130. So I'm not sure that this is sustainable and this can continue forever. On the other hand, on the deleveraging, the ideal would be basically to be as close as possible to net debt zero at the top of the cycle, and then re-lever at the bottom of the cycle. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you need to be careful with you know, your leverage, you know, throughout the cycle.
Oh, okay. So, no current plans for, you know, looking down the line for further acquisitions. It's sort of de-levering and being ready for the future. Is that how you would describe it?
Well, acquisitions... All the acquisitions that we have done in the past were share-for-share transactions. Mm. And it actually, it all the acquisitions that we did were at an NAV basis. Today, the entire sector is trading at significant discounts to NAV, which makes the transactions very difficult to be concluded.
Gotcha.
On the other hand, cash acquisitions are not... accretive to the shareholders, and you cannot justify a cash acquisition to a shareholder when your stock is trading at 30-40% discount to NAV. They will ask you, why don't you buy your own stock?
Yeah.
And you go and spend your cash to, you know, to buy, you know, vessels. So the markets need, the market needs to help before we see, you know, significant further acquisitions and you know, M&A activity.
Okay, you know who I'm going to ask next. Wiley, what do you think of that reaction?
Yeah, I think that's all completely rational because we're in a spot here where you're in, you know, choose your sector, but there's always going to be some sort of uncertainty where it's, you know, as I think about the broader transportation mantle, shipping and maybe airlines are probably the most volatile that we cover. And I think when things are more certain or you're in a let's call it a more risk-off environment, you can do some optimization. I think as opposed to optimization, as you're thinking about capital allocation, you're more focused now on creating option value, whether that's your balance sheet so that you're kind of the longest dated option in a volatile world from I'm going to stay financially afloat for as long as possible, or optionality in terms of your strategic set. So, you know, I don't think anybody accepted or expected the Golden Ocean transaction. And so, you know, I think people, certainly corporates and boards, are taking this opportunity, you know, in an environment that feels very chaotic and that could go in a variety of directions to really expand their horizons and explore the space. So I think deals are being talked about whether they'll happen or not, and I think people are planning capital and allowing themselves to entertain those deals if they come along. So whether or not we'll see the press releases hit the tape, TBD, but certainly the conversations that we're having are probably broader in terms of where we go on the strategic chessboard than they have been in a long time.
Okay. And for a first lien lender like First Citizens, Evan, what how do you view the market at the moment?
you know, that's an interesting one. I don't want to downplay it, but it's the next disruption with a different flavor and a different color. So a friend of mine always says champions adapt, shipping adapts. I mean, whether we have a COVID or a Suez Canal blockage or a sanction or a war zone, shipping finds a way. And I don't see how, and I think you're referring to the proposed port fees and tariffs.
Yeah.
The shipping will adapt. You start to look at the numbers, you go, okay, there'll be some change of trading pattern. I hear the owners on the last panel saying, well, that doesn't really hurt shipping. It typically doesn't.
Yeah, that was my takeaway from the last panel as well. Maybe some short-term effects, but the market, shipping industry will adjust.
For a boring senior lender, it's really the same story. It's who's the owner, who's the asset, how is it going to generate the cash to pay you back? So that doesn't really change. You have to check something else. You have to check KYC and sanctions and does it have a Chinese nexus you have to include in your cash flow projection? I'm not dismissing it. It's just the next column in the Excel spreadsheet. Sorry. I have to dismiss it.
I got it. And Harris, the alternative leasing market, I mean, is this you're doing quite well. I mean, alternative finance has been quite popular over the last 10 years or so. You see this changing anything that you do, or is it more your view is similar to Evan's?
I think you're right. It's becoming popular, and I said in the past that it's not alternative anymore. It's becoming mainstream because you know billions of dollars of leasing facilities have been put in place every year. I mean, the case in point is that we only set up the business less than 4 years ago, and we've grown very significantly. I asked Sykes, my colleague, earlier, what's the compounded annual rate of growth that we had? He said 150%. I said, no way. I couldn't believe it. But it's reality because despite, and this is an environment where there has been a resurgence of interest from the banking community in shipping. So in the mainstream shipping sectors, there is sufficient capacity. So against this backdrop of significant competition, we've been able to grow significantly. And this is on the back of what we've been able to offer our clients, which is flexibility and very fast decision making, and obviously also counter-cyclical approach, as opposed to the bank community that is a bit pro-cyclical by default because of regulations and everything else. So we've been able to pivot very quickly, for example, from mainstream assets into non-mainstream, like, for example, the offshore industry, and we've grown our presence significantly there because clearly it was an industry in need of funding, and funding was not available. So we continue to keep ourselves agile and to look at where the opportunities lie in the market. But one thing to add is that at least shipping is in the forefront of developments now. It attracts the attention it deserves. And it deserves that attention because it transports 90% of the world trade, and that's $15 to $17 trillion a year. So actually, it performs a very essential function, and I think rightly so, the various administrations around the world are paying the right attention to it now.
Do you see the uncertainty in
yes, we're talking primarily about port fees and tariffs and regulatory change. And I read the disclosure for a publicly traded company, and I'm always asked to read the regulatory bits for disclosure statement. And you know, it's a sizable piece of paper, just the regulatory bits. How do you see this as another risk factor in the disclosure that you have to make? Say, Chris, what do you think?
I mean, we all love risk factors. You know, the disclosures are abundant, but yeah, of course, this adds to it. You know, you're talking about regulatory changes and the changes in the port fees. That's if that comes into fruition. I know we had the hearings, and there's still more to come out, but of course, it's going to impact all segments. You know, I can and with product tankers in particular, you know, there's layers of port fees for Chinese built vessels that take effect depending on, you know, the percentage of your fleet that's Chinese built. If you're a Chinese operator, layers onto those fees. At Sting, we have 9% of our fleet is Chinese built. So we would fall in the lower tier, which relative to our peers is on the lower end of the range. And you know, more importantly, we don't have any new buildings on order. And if you look at the order book, especially for product tankers, for LR2s, it's over 80%.
That's one of the things that the proposed fees would look at.
Right.
The fees are, and we're talking about the Chinese port fees. They look at whether the vessel's Chinese built. They look if it's Chinese operated, if it's part of a fleet that includes Chinese built vessels, and whether the operator has vessels on order from Chinese yards. All of those create fees,
right,
as proposed would create fees, and pretty substantial ones. There's also an element about trading to and from the U.S. with a certain amount of exports being required to go out on U.S. Operated U.S. flagged vessels. What do you think of that? Is that going to change your strategy at all?
Well, you have to look at the routing of imports and exports of crude products. Okay, and you know, it's not going to change our strategy in as much as we take a global look perspective on this. And if the U.S. puts heavy tariffs on Canadian crude, Mexican crude, which import into the U.S., you know, it's going to squeeze refining margins in the U.S. And what's going to end up happening is the U.S. is going to actually end up importing refined products, and that's actually good for ton mile demand. China is not really a big exporter of products, so it's really just a neutral effect there, but. That's how we look at it. We look at it as, you know, holistically, how are the trading patterns going to change if these fees are put, if these tariffs are put into place, especially on crude oil.
And Simos, do you have any thoughts on that? You're neutral on it.
Well, on the dry bulk side, I would say that less than 10% of the dry bulk trade is U.S. related. About half of the fleet that is calling U.S. ports is Chinese built. So it's mostly on the medium size, the Kamsarmax size, but there are some Ultras and Supras as well. So in the short term, this is going to create some, chaos. I think that, you know, you're going to see probably, first of all, it's uncertainty, as we said before. We're not sure if the tariffs are going to start on dry bulk or other asset classes first, which is going to be prioritized. But if tariffs are here to stay, the implications that we're going to see is they're going to be, you know, we're going to see some change in the trade routes. We're going to see probably, you know, Chinese-built vessels primarily catering the Pacific area and, you know, Japanese and Korean vessels being calling the U.S. ports. We are going to see probably, a reduction or stop of ordering of Chinese vessels, which is going to be good for dry bulk. Definitely, because as we said before, Japanese yards are fully booked up until, 2028, so I'm not sure where they're going to build. So it's a combination of probably positive factors on the short term, maybe, a bit negative on the long term, but together with the fact that we're going to see reduction of order book on, Chinese shipyards, probably overall it's going to be positive.
Okay, interesting. I mean, I was told when I was visiting Germany last year that EU, and it was mentioned on the last panel that part of the move to use more U.S. flag vessels is obviously problematic. Because, first of all, Chinese yards have gotten very good at what they do. And that was a little bit of news to me, that people now, ship owners, some are preferring Chinese yards over other Asian yards and certainly over U.S. yards. I want to shift the focus a little bit back to finance because that's what we're doing here. Harris, how do you see all of this affecting, the markets and what ship owners are looking for? What is your feel of that in terms of types of finance and structures and ingenuity in finance types? Is there change in that area? Are we moving away, for example, from Chinese leasing as a result of all of this?
Certainly, this administration decided to use tariffs as a commercial tool, if you will, to discuss and negotiate with other participants, and as opposed to multilateral trade deals that take much longer to materialize. So I suppose, what happens now is very quick in a sense. But obviously it creates a lot of uncertainty at interim. And I think most governments around the world are now focusing on three things, which is security, affordability, and then the environment. Whereas in the past, certainly in Europe, we started with the environment without really thinking of affordability or security. So security of supply is key on a number of fronts, definitely with regards to commodities and raw materials. There's a lot of discussion about critical minerals right now. So that's going to create flows for shipping. And there's definitely a lot of discussion about power and energy. So in that context of security, affordability and environment, I think we as Neptune are very well positioned because we are, European run. Our majority shareholders include Costa Mare Shipping, which is a container shipping company listed here in the New York Stock Exchange, and the Latsco Family Office, which is again European based. So in that respect, we have a competitive advantage, I suppose, which is manifesting itself recently with the client orders that we see.
And Evan, it's a big part of what First Citizens does, I understand, is back funding for leasing houses. Do you see that continuing for what you do, or what's been your experience with that?
It's been a very good experience, and I see it continuing. I think there's enough leasing houses out there, Neptune included, that there's competition. So for them to get projects, they need to be cost competitive. So they look to a First Citizens or someone else who has very competitive pricing or competitive capital. So we're very comfortable with groups like Neptune because they know about shipping, and the deals they bring actually brings us an extra layer of equity, if you will. So there's another layer between us and the asset, or between us and the risk. So we're still very close to the asset.
Why is that a good thing, having an extra layer of equity?
Because there's another group that has more to lose than we do.
Okay. Got it.
And if you like the ship and you like the people who run it or have invested their time and effort into it, you still have a good deal. So that continues. So we're comfortable with that. And our traditional clients, whether it's bilateral or larger group deal or syndication, the traditional clients we're still seeing a lot of good deal flow from and good business. So if we take this all back 4 weeks, let's say, so pre-Chinese story, we're a reliable source of capital. We're very competitive pricing. We find business to do.
Yeah. And I'm just curious what your view, Wiley, on the market side. The overall effect on the markets from the change has been somewhat negative, I guess I would say. What's your perspective on the markets going forward?
Yeah, that's a loaded question. But I think your initial summary is right. I mean, the volatility has caused, I think, a bit of a risk-off, increased premium, certainly in the equity markets. And as Simos pointed out, a lot of companies are trading well below the value of their steel. And so I think what we're seeing is investors, as always, kind of the initial shift is to try to seek a safe haven. And then they'll start looking for mispriced opportunities. So I think the equity market, although we'll kind of go from the initial risk premium as people try to figure it out, the value of, I'll call it pure play, but what I mean is exposure to something, right? Like if investors love being able to play something that looks undervalued. And so I do think there'll be some trading around certain names and certain sectors. And as we all know, there's kind of fewer public companies in each one of those sectors. So I think you'll start to see some activity there.
As Simo said earlier, that the values to the trading values versus NAV is a very large gap these days. And just kind of curious what your view on that is.
Yeah, I think, shipping is one of those, people like to play it when it's sunny. And when the sun isn't shining, it's a little less popular, although from a fundamental valuation perspective to that point, it's really attractive. So if you have the appetite to hang in there and your view is it's when, not if, then you have to get your timing right as you think about your investment return. So I think we'll see there's a bit of an exodus that's resulted in these kind of valuations. And whether it's buybacks or, hedge funds and medium-sized institutions starting to play things because they have a contrarian view, that's what we'll see. But stocks are cheap.
You see hedge funds being more active in the shipping space?
They're having a really tough time now because of the volatility, but there's going to, when they develop their thesis, there's going to be a handful of companies with, like Starbulk and like Scorpio and others who have built up good trading volumes, and so they can come in and out of those stocks and create opportunities.
That's a good point. And we haven't talked because we have two very big ship owners on the panel, but we haven't talked about smaller companies and what they're doing these days. Maybe I'd turn it over to Evan. That's part of your focus at First Citizens.
Sure. We have the luxury of working with companies, whether they're medium-sized or larger, that we like. And we always have fun with the medium-sized, smaller owners. And there's still opportunities for them to buy the assets that maybe the larger companies want to divest from or Wiley's convincing them to sell. And how do we help them? We help them with availability of capital, as long as they have enough equity in the ship. And also revolvers. So even the medium-sized owners benefited from this wonderful market we've had the past 5-plus years and have generated cash. But they want to maintain a bank relationship or they want to maintain the loan facility without redocumenting it. So we give them the ability to draw down when they see an interesting project or two and the ability to repay without closing down the loan facility. So it's still an active source of business.
Mm. One of the things that's coming out of it, I've just been interested in this Chinese port fees, and I apologize if I'm dominating the discussion with all of that. But one of the suggestions, and I think Wiley, you touched on it earlier, is that there might be some repositioning of fleets or repositioning of companies in anticipation of these fees. Do you agree with that? Or we've already seen it. I mean, it's been reported that some companies are selling off their Chinese-built vessels. Do you see future in that? I mean, we talked a little bit earlier about M&A opportunities, but what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's – so my comment earlier, the primary sentiment is that people are talking about anything, right? So one of the things they're talking about is managing the portfolio, whether that's the fleet or just, you know, anything within the company, to position ahead of whether it's port fees, tariffs, anything else. And I think there's a trading opportunity because vessels, there's typically a relatively liquid secondhand market for ships, just like there is for stock. So some folks who are planning on selling Chinese-built ships may be more compelled to sell those if prices are holding up. So I don't think there's going to be a full fleet realignment. I think it would be premature to make those kind of capital decisions ahead of, you know,
whatever comes out of all these hearings.
The comment period. Exactly. But I do think people are trying to figure out, like, you know, do I need to be ready? Is there capital required around that? And, you know, who would be my counterparties if I was going to do something?
Okay. Any comments from the ship owner end of the table?
I mean, I agree with everything you're saying, Wiley. It's funny. I mean, are these port tariffs or port fees temporary? And should we, as ship owners, be restructuring our organizations, selling off our Chinese-built ships if the administration is just using these fees as a negotiating tactic? Yep. And 3 months from now, they're gone.
Yep.
So, you know, I think if you do get some sense that this will fix itself into shipping, yeah, you're going to see changes. But I think we're still kind of far from that. Everybody's a little bit, I don't know, shell-shocked that this is happening. And, you know, and then in terms of actually putting actionable items on paper in terms of how we're going to deal with this, I think is the next step, and all owners are going to approach it differently, whether it's different legal structures, whether it's avoiding trading in the U.S., whether it's selling Chinese ships. You know, we're sure that it will somewhat create a two-tiered market for non-Chinese built vessels. There already is one, and that difference will expand further because of this.
Simos, I see you nodding as well.
I agree.
You agree?
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, I think probably, you know, these tariffs are here to stay. We have to be conservative. We are going to, you know, in order to be able to sustain, you know, such a market, you have to keep, you know, having as low as possible costs. We're going to see some reshuffling of trading. I think at the end we are going to see, you know, a disparity in terms of valuation between Chinese and non-Chinese built vessels.
Mm. Okay. Well, let me shift gears a little bit more. I mean, this is obvious, a current topic, and it impacts financing. There was an entire panel on it earlier, but in terms of sustainable shipping, want to kind of hear from first maybe the ship owners what they're doing in sustainable shipping. Is this charging ahead? Are we taking a pause? What's the individual positions of your companies? Simos, you just spoke, but go ahead. Why don't you field that one?
Well, we have been, you know, as Starbulk in the forefront of sustainability and the overall ESG agenda. I have to remind the group here that we have already issued our sixth ESG report, and we are currently preparing the seventh. We participate as a company in a number of green initiatives and R&D projects. We have installed to our entire fleet the ballast water treatment system and energy-saving devices, telemetry equipment to reduce our consumption and carbon emissions. So we are actively investing in ESG. Now, on the investor side, I have to admit that we have been seeing more sensitive ESG investors in the past than currently. I remember we had meetings with investors back in 2019 and 2018 that were telling us, transport coal, basically we're not allowed to invest in your company. We haven't seen this lately. And I think this is probably, you know, another consequence of all the, you know, the agenda of the new administration.
So you feel like the pendulum is swung a little bit and maybe coming back, or is that too much to say?
I'm not sure. I think it will get back, but you know, at a slower pace now.
Okay, Chris, do you want to add anything to that?
I mean, we're not taking a pause. I mean, we take ESG seriously, and you know, what we love at Scorpio is where, you know, the goals of sustainability intersect with economics. You know, that we were one of the first companies to roll out scrubbers on our fleet. That was sort of the Goldilocks scenario. But we keep testing the waters on other technologies. We're rolling out fuel emulsification systems on all of our ships. You know, it's a minor investment. It's you know, single digit percentage point savings on our fuel consumption. But it's things that we pursue like that. We have a joint venture with a fleet of five methanol carriers. You know, we also have a partnership, which we announced a couple of years ago, with a firm that's researching carbon capture on board, and we're using our ships to explore that and doing feasibility studies and things like that. So we're still taking it seriously, you know, and I know the pendulum is swinging, but it's kind of early to tell. But
for the finance end of the table. Are you all on board with sustainable shipping and financing sustainable shipping? Are you agnostic? Harris, why don't you tell us?
I'll say a couple of things. First of all, you know, we've seen the pendulum is swinging back a little bit. And that's normal because, you know, it's easy to talk about net zero when interest rates are zero, but it's actually difficult to talk about it when interest rates are 5%. Because it becomes much more costly. And these are long-term investments, so you need to carry them for a long period of time. On the other hand, we try to follow a much more pragmatic approach. And we did this on the back of numbers. In fact, if you look at the fleet today, about 45% of tankers, bulkers, and container ships, if nothing changes, that there's pirates are going to be classified D or E on CII, by 2026. And that's something we need to deal with. And how do we deal with it? By introducing these energy-saving devices. But we actually, first thing we did a couple of years ago is we agreed to actually facilitate the investment into energy-saving devices. So we have a lot of clients that bought a bit older ships, but by adding those devices and improvements like bubbles, you know, bows, propellers, etc., they've been able to improve the rating of their vessels. So that's number one, which is very tangible. At the same time, we actually, you know, did a research. We hired consultants, you know, Lloyd's Register and others, and we had a discussion about how is the regulation going to affect older ships, for example. We ran examples of a couple of Kamsarmaxes, even like a 10-year-old Kamsarmax. How is that going to be affected by the imposition of the new rules? And it seems to me, if the owner wants to make sure that the vessel stays at level C of CII, you need to make certain investments on the vessel. But even those investments can only get you up to 2030 or 31. So after that, the ship is not, again, economical. Mm-hmm. So definitely you need to blend in the biofuels. So that's the only real solution, I suppose, to improving your carbon footprint. But guess what? There are not enough biofuels around. So how is everybody going to be able to, you know, purchase biofuels when there's not enough production of biofuels? So it's going to be pretty hard to meet those targets unless you decide to go on and build a new vessel, and that will be compliant for much longer period after that.
Yep. So, Evan, any love it, hate it? I know we're almost out of time, but you got 12 seconds.
We rely on compliance, smart clients. I was very interested to hear what my colleagues here said. They are doing this to be compliant, be good corporate citizens, and to be strategically placed to win business from their competitors. So that's great, the kind of clients we want. It's, of course, we're all citizens of the world, so we want to see a cleaner place. But it falls on them, and it helps them generate cash to repay their capital. Fantastic.
Fantastic. Wiley, any thoughts from the – we heard Simos talk about meeting with investors.
I agree with all, but I don't think investor sentiment has changed that much. Like the pendulum analogy, I would just modify that. Just my view is that the trajectory's flattened a little bit. We do a lot of compliance internally as we think about lending, as we think about our advisory business. I can think of a company we advised a couple weeks ago. It's like a $35 billion company. They're looking at what they're going to look like in 10 years. They're probably lightening up on oil and gas exposure because they feel like that's a declining business as they think about long-term cash flow. So I think, to Harris's point, the economics matter, and that's going to drive most business decisions. And I think the compliance piece of it has been at a steep trajectory. It's probably flattened out a little bit, and that's going to be part of it, too, to Evan's point.
Gentlemen, thank you so very much.
Thanks, John.
It's been very interesting, and we'll see what happens.